Hello and welcome back to the Not So Fit Couple podcast with your hosts Lucy Davis
and Benjamin Holden.
Today we are joined by the wonderful Devi Schreeder, who is a professor and the chair of global health at Edinburgh University Medical School and also a level 3 personal trainer.
To add that credential, she's also the writer of best-selling book Preventable, which is about how a pandemic changed the world and how to stop the next one. In this week's conversation, we cover some super exciting topics of how Devi has transitioned into becoming a personal trainer, a lot of stuff around health implications and COVID around the World Cup, as well as speaking about this, how China is masking the public from what's actually going on in the world and around the World Cup.
Yeah, it's literally wild. And some of the topics that I definitely resonated with was how women are not necessarily listened to as much in the fitness space or politics.
Please make sure to subscribe to the podcast.
Give it a
like. Especially if you watch it on YouTube. Yeah, there's still a lot of you unsubscribed. Hit that subscribe button. Leave us a review and enjoy.
Enjoy, guys.
What makes a professor of public health want to become a personal trainer?
I think it's seeing how important exercise is to keeping people healthy and preventing illness. Like, so much of what we've seen in the data is that people are ill because they're not active enough or their diet is off. And so some people who work in public health end up being clinicians. They work in clinics. They have like 2 days a week where they're in hospital. And I was like, actually, wouldn't it be better to be 2 days a week in a gym or in a park and actually keeping people healthy instead of trying to help them once they're actually on the other end and unwell. Mm-hmm. And we know exercise is incredibly effective, probably the most effective intervention in terms of trying to keep people well and out of the medical system.
Mm-hmm. During COVID, we did a podcast and we literally titled it The Relationship Between COVID and Obesity. And there was some people who just were not happy with that title of the podcast, but that was one of those things where nobody was saying it. I think, was it the June of the, yes, when the pandemic, yes, started? We came out with this podcast because we were looking into it thinking, look, there's a massive correlation. I mean, we're not medical professionals, but we knew there was a correlation between obesity and people having COVID and people actually passing away from having it. And we got quite a bad amount of backlash, I would say, from that podcast because we used the words COVID and obesity in the same sentence.
Yeah, but actually you guys are spot on. I think where people get a bit kind of reactive is if they think it's blaming, like, mm-hmm, blaming people for dying of COVID or being sick with it, instead of recognizing, which I guess you guys do, that if people are overweight, they need to be supported. It's not anything to do with blaming. It has to do a lot with like the time you have, the life you live, even your underlying genetics and things like that. And so just recognizing that, yeah, if you look at countries, like, I know there's been a lot of talk about Sweden and Denmark and Norway, and the biggest difference is they have lower obesity rates. They had quite a healthy population, so they could take the same wave of cases that we could take, or Japan, for example, but they had much fewer hospitalizations and deaths because people were able to manage COVID better because their underlying health was better.
Mm-hmm. Quite a lot of our listeners are personal trainers or in the midst of becoming personal trainers. And one of the things that me and Lucy have spoken about quite often is how much it often pisses off within the fitness industry of people who are there to make a quick buck, or people who don't even have the qualifications in the first place to then be able to go in and coach people. How did you find the whole process of going through that in terms of working with the government bodies and taking the personal training exams? And how did you also manage that on top of all the other things that you probably had on your plate during the pandemic as well?
Well, it's funny because, like, some people, you know, I was probably the oldest one on the course, and they're, you know, the younger guys are thinking she's having a midlife crisis. We all have our own midlife crisis during COVID, right? Where we have these things of like, what do I want to do with my life? And I think for me, it was like, actually, I really enjoy doing fitness. Can I do this in a more expert way? Mm-hmm. And I think going into it, like, for me, is with a lot of humility, like, to be able to work with someone in their body, it's so complex. And so I think instead of thinking like, oh, you just need to kind of learn a certain set of exercises and everyone can do them, learning like, how do you work with an individual or a group of individuals, tailor a program towards them, understand, it is really actually much more detail than when I went into it. To like get anatomy, you're getting physiology, you're understanding energy systems, you have to understand diet, you have to understand the joints, because people obviously as get older have joint issues, getting into issues with people who have like maybe chronic health issues or, mm-hmm, disabled. So I think humility is the word, which is that I feel like I'm constantly learning. And the best way to learn is to look at experienced PTs and watch what they do with their clients and get their advice and listen to them. Because for me, like getting the certification, like the first step, it's like, I still don't feel fully expert enough to be able to take someone with complex health needs and say, oh, I can help you. So yeah, that's kind of my thing, which is constantly be learning and listening to people who've done this for years and years and say, oh, actually, how do I work with this person? Even something like deadlifts, like RDLs, it so much depends on someone's body proportions. Otherwise, they could really throw their back. And so understanding how do you work with someone who's 6'5", who's maybe like a big guy, and then how do you work with someone who's maybe quite petite? It'd be quite different. So just recognizing there's the theory and there's the coursework and then there's real life, and real life like apprenticeship for me is the best way, just shadowing people and learning from them.
I think that's the thing with personal training. It's quite a saturated industry. There's so much in the fitness industry, especially on social media, because we work obviously quite heavily on there. And we see people and we're thinking, do you have your qualifications? Are you giving them like a cookie cutter plan? So coming into the fitness space as a personal trainer, have you seen, I guess, any of the bullshit, to put it politely, and things like that in the fitness industry where you've just been like biting your tongue? We do it all the time because we see things, and I mean, we don't actually bite our tongue. We just say it how it is because that's what we're like as people and we rather be transparent. But coming from your perspective, have you seen anything that you've just been like, oh my goodness, like this is what I'm now dealing with?
Oh, of course. I think it's like one thing has been like the fad diets and like, you know, the whole promotion for like, oh, you drink this and you lose, you know, 10 pounds. So the first thing is, I think, you know, what I would call false advertising and the promotion of kind of products that are actually gonna be quite unhealthy. And linked to that, just the obsession with weight and like weight loss and weight gain, where you can have people who, according to like their BMI, are overweight, but are incredibly healthy in terms of other measurements, where then you can have people who you might consider traditionally thin, but they couldn't walk a mile. And so actually their internal age, their health isn't very good. So kind of the obsession. And then another thing is, I think, is like six packs and like, oh, this is the exercise to do to get a six pack, where it's actually much more to do with your diet and probably also your body composition. So just trying to get away from these kind of quick fix clickbait, which is like, click here and get a six pack in 2 weeks with these four ab exercises. I see that and I'm just like, where do we even start? Whereas I guess coming from public health, I'm more interested in someone's fitness. If someone can run 2 miles, do 50 push-ups, and their blood pressure is low, then if they're on BMI overweight, I'm not concerned. I'm like, actually, they're pretty fit. Whereas if you have people with like low BMI and you think, oh, they're healthy, many of them are actually just either starving themselves or eating really unhealthily and not able to. So I think it's that kind of thing where we get away from the clickbait to actually the deeper messages.
Go on. Sorry, I had a really cool question.
Speaking of working with clients, I mean, I made the switch about 6 years ago. I actually used to work for the police force in the UK and became a personal trainer and kind of made that switch over to a different career path. And one of the clients that I work with has become, or one of the first clients I work with has become quite a close friend. But I believe it one of your first clients was a slightly more well known than that, in a Scottish politician potentially.
Oh yeah, so this was when I was doing my certification. I had just regular calls with Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, and one of the things I was raising, we were under such intense pressure and stress, was just, are you exercising? Like, are you taking care of yourself? And I guess she said, well, I should be exercising more, which is probably what a lot of people would say with busy jobs. And so I said, well, you know, next time you want to meet for squats in the park and chat, we could do it over that. And I think there is now kind of this awareness that also, if you are in a really stressful job, you probably need to exercise even more. And that's when I think like PTs can come into the mix, because they're for people who maybe don't have time to think and design a program themselves. They just want to come in, have someone help them reach their goals. And so kind of just getting that out there, that it's just, you know, I hate the idea that exercise is a luxury. I mean, it should be there for everybody, whether you're really busy or not, to find that time and that space and then have others support you with it.
Can I just ask this is unrelated to what Ben just said then, but just from what you said before regarding if someone has a slightly bigger BMI, they can still be healthy, fully. Yeah, absolutely. I think my BMI is nearly over because I'm so muscly. But I don't know if you saw it, but I think it was just after the pandemic, there was a cover, I think it was Cosmopolitan or yeah. one of them, where it had, yeah, I don't know if it was Tess Holliday, someone was on the cover who isn't, she is an obese woman, and they say this is healthy. I was just curious about your opinion about that whole movement and the way it kind of comes across as health or not healthy.
Yeah, I think like this is, I guess, part of the body positivity movement, which I think yeah. has been great in a lot of ways, because we moved away from like, you know, the Kate Moss, weigh thin, starve yourself kind of generation to actually one which embraces curvier shapes, mm-hmm. kind of a range of body types. But coming back to kind of, you know, as a PT, one of the first things you learn is how to do an assessment of someone of where they are, because then you can monitor progress. And it's coming back to, are they at a weight where they feel they're able to be physically fit? They're able to run or cycle or do whatever they want to do in their daily lives. And I think when you're at a weight, when you're not able to do that, that we have to be cautious of saying, oh, that's healthy. Mm-hmm. I think we have to come back to, you know, I think the great thing about exercise, it lets you do everything you want to do in your day. You can walk your dog, you can run after your kids, you can, you know, help your grandparents move something. It enables you to do something. Same with strength. Like, I think I see, you know, all kinds of people lifting in the gym. In the end, it's about strength in your daily life more than the showy Instagram or look at my muscles. I'm like, what are you doing with that muscle mm-hmm. in your life to kind of enable things? So yeah, but then on the flip side, I think there's also like shaming of people and like larger size clothing, which isn't helpful. Like if I see someone in the gym who's overweight or in a quite a large size, I actually think, great, like good for you that you're in here and you're trying to get healthier. Mm-hmm. So I think instead of kind of shaming people, already it's hard if you know if you're bigger. I've put on weight in a few times in my life and you can feel how people treat you differently mm-hmm. when you're, you know, 30, 40 pounds heavier than your normal weight. We have to be careful not to shame people, because in the end, like if you see someone's running, is it heavier, or someone in the gym lifting, I always think like, that's awesome. Like great for them. And we have to make clothes for people of all sizes. Yeah. The idea of like, you have to be, but on the same side, I have to think we do have to be cautious with embracing obesity. If it impairs your daily life, which is what it actually does, if you are really overweight, you can't really walk without losing breath, you can't go upstairs, things like that, which you want to be able to do at all ages.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think it's sometimes a difficult kind of conversation to tread, and people are often scared of being cancelled or having backlash from talking around that topic in particular. And we know that from having excess adipose tissue that there's certain health risks that come with it. But then at the same time, we've got to kind of create this space where those people who need the help and those people who should be in gyms and need to be in gyms feel relatable and feel like they can go to those places as well. So it is a difficult line to tread. And I think sometimes the magazines just choose extremes to cause conversation because they know that that's what's going to get clicks. And then ultimately there's big backlash from it as well. I still don't think there's probably as much inclusion for the male fitness space as the potential as the women. I think we've seen a lot of different shapes and different body types, which is great to represent the different population of female fitness, but I still don't think there's as much in male. I think even still, like if you look at Nike and Gymshark, I know Nike did that campaign, didn't they, where they had the big
mannequin,
the larger size mannequins, yeah, which is more representative, but I still don't think there's as much of that in the male space potentially.
I think that's completely right. And it is probably because like there are women, like I think role models are so important of who we look to. Yep. And if you think of like, and women, there have been quite a few really prominent women saying, this is my body shape, it's more curvaceous, or women come in different sizes, or even embracing like different ethnicities, you know, are shaped differently. Like we carry fat differently depending if you're African or Asian or British. And so I think, or, you know, whatever it is. And so having that kind of awareness of diversity, and also that fitness is for everyone. Like you have to start somewhere. I think a lot of people kind of, I think the paradox of fitness is the more fit you are, the more exercise you want to do. Mm-hmm. And then you get more and more fit because you're really enjoying it. Cause you're like, oh, yeah. I can run a mile. I'm going to run 2 miles. I'm going to do a marathon. Where the more sedentary you are, the harder it is even to walk.
Yeah.
So you become more and more sedentary. So just trying to get people to take those baby steps, which is sometimes when you see, you know, all you see on Instagram is people running marathons and lifting like double their body weight, actually saying to people, start somewhere, like go for a walk, extend your walking time, try to jog a bit of it, go to the gym, lift weights. Don't be afraid of weights. I think a lot of people are think like, oh, they're going to lift like 10 kilos and they're going to end up muscular. A lot of women, you probably see this as well. I'm like, it's actually really hard to build muscle. like yeah. of that kind. So just taking away some of those myths as well.
That can sometimes be a difficult thing as well, because often with, for example, when you work with clients, for those who may be severely overweight or have quite a lot of body fat tissue to lose, saying to someone, well, actually, we just need to leave the gym alone right now, and we just need to start with doing walking, getting those daily steps in and getting that energy expenditure and focus on those habits, can sometimes be difficult because they think that's not enough, and they think what they are paying for, they need to be getting more out of the service than that. And people often look at this thing like complexity bias, where people like to look at those complex solutions instead of the simple ones, because they think, right, if it's harder, it's going to work more for me. And that's where people jump in the deep end instead of paddling and learn how to swim first. And that can sometimes be something that's difficult to overcome, because when things seem simple or easy, they don't think it's going to be as impactful maybe as something that's a more of a complex plan.
I think that's completely right. I mean, you see this even in the medical, you know, industry, the move towards like obesity pills and, you know, going for surgeries, and which do have a place for a small section of the population. But for the vast majority of people, as you're saying, it's simple things. And I think also like that you can't really, which you guys know really well, you can't outrun a bad diet. Mm-hmm. So no matter what you're doing in the gym, if your diet's not aligned with that and with your goals, and so again, trying to bring back to simple things, which is, okay, let's look at your diet, what's happening in there, what's modifiable, what are easy swaps you can make, things like that, where I think that the idea that you can just go to a gym and do everything you can there and leave the rest of your life as it is. Yeah, that's a clear thing we have to kind of talk to people about and address.
On the topic of gyms, Debbie, what are your thoughts on the closures that took place on gyms during lockdown?
Well, obviously pretty awful, but a lot of things were shut down. Schools were shut down, which we know had huge ramifications for kids. We know it was everything, nightclubs, cafes. It was generally a measure to try to stop the spread of an infectious disease, and gym environments are conducive to that, right? You have a lot of people inside. But I think as soon as possible, there was idea of trying to open up and make gyms spaces. And actually, I did hear from PTs that they actually quite enjoyed that in classes. There were limited numbers, that there was actually spacing on equipment, there was disinfection, like things that anyways are good to do.
Yeah.
But hopefully never again, though I hope it also encouraged people to realize fitness can happen outdoors. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So seeing a lot of PTs moving outdoors, but also virtual training. So I think one of the models I also saw was PTs moving to kind of like a subscription service, which is that instead of seeing your PT like once a week in the gym for an hour, you might actually, you know, every day get an email from them, which is like checking in the plan, and then have like a virtual session. And in some ways, hopefully all we saw was a transition to a hybrid kind of model, which for people who want to work on a kind of subscription model and do virtual sessions can do that. And then people who really want to go back inside can now go back into gyms. And so again, diversifying kind of income sources, I guess, in terms of to clients, what do they actually want? And some people are just want someone to tell them each day, do this, and they are happy to go do it. And others want to go into the gym and actually see someone for that hour and then forget about it the rest of the week.
Mm-hmm.
You basically just plugged our business perfectly there, Debbie.
That's what we are solely based online now. So during the pandemic, one of the things we had to do was completely just switch to more home-based workouts. So we were doing a lot of live workouts with people, because at the end of the day, everyone was a bit bored, and not having the ability to get in your car, drive to the gym, have your pre-workout, enjoy your session, come home, that part of their day had been removed. I think for our audience, because we didn't love home training, did we? We're not massive fans of home training, but we made this kind of gym in our back garden and just pieced this thing together in a tent, and we just kind of did whatever we could actually do to, for us and definitely for me anyway, training and exercise is a massive stress release. So when COVID happened in the pandemic, my anxiety went through the roof, because I have anxiety anyway. And then the gym was taken away. I was like, oh, good God, I don't know what to do with myself. But that was one of the things we did. It was kind of detached from what we needed to do, and then also just moved to home workouts, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think am I coming across?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, I think you froze for a sec, but you're fine.
Okay, yeah. I think like in a way the world has changed since COVID and how it made us adjust even in ways that we're uncomfortable with, in terms of like home workouts, outdoor workouts, YouTube videos, you know, kind of people working in those mediums. But I think there's still a place for gyms. Mm-hmm. And what we have seen is, like, if you look at gym attendance, it's probably very close to where it was pre-lockdown, where, like, going to offices isn't. So you see people are choosing to go to things like gyms, not yeah. just for the exercise, but for the social reasons as well. So yeah, I mean, as I said, like, the pandemic was awful. And I think obviously gyms took a huge hit, but looking at how infectious the virus was and how dangerous it was in March 2020, like 3 years ago, there wasn't really many options in terms of protecting people at yeah. that stage. And we do have seen a lot of people who are very fit having long COVID, as well as personal trainers. And then that's mm-hmm. like, if we had widespread exposure and a lot of people getting really ill, going to hospital, having long COVID without any kind of protection from vaccines or anything else, that would have been in a way equally devastating mm-hmm. as, you know, having closures and the associated kind of strain that took.
Yeah.
We
recently had a guest on. I don't know if you may have seen him in the news at the time, Nick Wickham. He was one of the guys who was standing up against the government and protesting to try and keep gyms open during lockdown. I think it was more so it was the Liverpool area that was put into, was it level 3,
yeah,
where the rest
levels,
of the country was level 2. Do you think he had a point in terms of standing up against the government in order to try and keep gyms open?
Well, I think you saw advocates like this in every sector. If I go through, whether it was like cafes or nightclubs or theaters or each of the venues, there are people standing up saying this is really important for mental health reasons, for yeah. livelihoods, for a range of things. And so it is quite hard for a government, because you are hearing people like him on one issue, but you're also hearing them on many others.
Yeah.
And in the end, there was a virus spreading that would have crashed hospital services. And that wouldn't have just affected people dying of COVID. It would have affected anyone needing care. So your child having asthma, your grandmother having a heart attack, someone having a stroke. And so the idea was to preserve healthcare services. We had to kind of slow the spread of the virus or stop it as much as possible before there being ways to effectively keep people out of hospital, which was vaccines. And so, of course, I'm sympathetic to those views. But I think my pushback to people like that is like, well, what was your solution? Like, what would you have done if you had a gym where 500 people came, 300 got COVID, 30 ended up in hospital, and I don't know, 5 of those died? Is that unacceptable? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the kind of conversations we have to have, because there were trade-offs. There was no perfect path forward. Mm-hmm. And maybe if there had been more time and more ability to have those discussions, we could have had people like that in the room and said, okay, what do you propose? So yeah, we could have probably done better with outdoor gyms. How do we actually repurpose outdoor spaces? Yeah. How do we quickly move to that? But I think also, at least like in Scotland, the real priority was children in schools. And so a lot of the efforts in terms of kind of trying to keep things open was like, if we have to close down everything, at least schools could stay open for children, because that was seen as a priority if you had to prioritize. And unfortunately, that's really difficult, because for everyone, they have a different priority. And then I guess it's up to the government to look across this and say, of the priorities, which is the most important. And I think, yeah, both in Britain and in Scotland, like in each of the devolved governments, I think schools came first, and then other things came along. And when you saw things opening up, you probably saw that priority list. Mm-hmm. But of course, if you're working in the nightclub sector, which is one of the last things to open, you would have been like, why are we the last to open? We mm-hmm. should have been the first to open. And so in a way, you just get into kind of debates with people. And I guess I could come back to solutions, which was like, well, what is your solution? We have to come back to basic facts. This is a virus. It spreads like this. You're likely to see this many infections, this many end up in hospital. If all the gyms open, this is the wave we're going to take. Those people go home to their families. How many of those families have multi-generations? How many of those people work in care homes or family members? Then you start realizing the complexity, and then you can work towards solutions, which is like, okay, we all want the same thing, but how do we do it in a way that means that we keep hospitals running, we keep people from dying, and we keep gyms open? And that was the trade-offs and the puzzles. Yeah. So I think I do listen to the advocates, but I always say to them, well, what was your solution? What mm-hmm. else could we have done? And I guess someone like him, I don't know what he'd say, but in the end, the government prioritizes. And I guess they prioritize, okay, we're going to first open something, schools. And once we got schools opening, we'll open other things. And I think gyms and leisure centers, yeah, they could have been prioritized similar to the Eat Out to Help Out scheme. I don't know why mm-hmm. that decision was made for hospitality, but that, in the end, that's a government decision that was far beyond what I was involved with.
Regarding the schools, was it only primary schools and high schools? Because myself and Ben recently went into talk at Manmet, didn't we? Manchester Metropolitan, is that the right one? Uni. And we gave this talk, and every single student was just silent and they didn't speak and no questions. And we were like, are they third years? This is really odd. Like, no one has a question. It's part of their degree. And we asked the lecturer at the end and he said, this is the first time they've been together in 3 years. They've only known each other for 6 weeks because of COVID. And I was like, oh my God, they don't even know each other. They've done a degree for 3 years together and they don't have a clue who their classmates are. So were universities not a priority at the time? Was it more so just primary schools and high schools, and then uni was just a bit kind of you do you?
Well, I think unis would say they were open, but for kind of like with all virtual learning, so students were still getting their lectures and their experience, but obviously not in the same way of being in a lecture or like classroom like you guys were in. But again, I think the priorities was made were like first early years, like nurseries, and then you work through to the primaries and then to the secondaries, and then at university level, you could do much more with virtual learning. But again, I think, you know, huge mental health cost to that.
Yeah.
But what was the alternative? And I think that's what it comes back to. Like, we did know looking at the states that when universities went for in-person return, you saw huge waves in the community, and those waves would always be associated with a massive rise in hospitalizations and then in deaths. And so, and again, the debate becomes, okay, if you open for in-person learning, what's an acceptable death toll for that? And that's a discussion nobody ever wants to have, right?
Yeah.
Because we just want life to be like it was without a disease. But in the end, we have a disease and it kills people. It still kills people. But we kind of, as a society, said we want to stay open. And so we use vaccinations and boosters and therapeutics, and we try to save everyone we can. But, you know, you look at the numbers in the United States, it's still like some days 700-800 people dying a day. It's not insignificant. It's still a top 10 cause of disease in Britain. And in terms of death, that's why we have an excess death mortality. It's COVID layering on top of everything else. So I guess that's kind of, I think, the difficulty, that it's, of course, we wanted life to be like before, but it was how to do that in a way. And so much of it, I think, is like personal too. Like, when I talk to uni students, one will tell me how horrible it's been being isolated for 3 years. And another will tell me how her mom died of COVID and why didn't we do more? And so I feel like my thing of COVID when I speak to people is just to have empathy, because everyone lived it in a different way. And whether you have long COVID or whether your business suffered and went under just when it was taking off, it's going to shape what you thought of the response mechanisms. And that's just how we are as human, right? Like, we respond to what happens to us. So it was obviously now great that we're having back to in-person return for university students. And there's a huge issue of getting that kind of cohesion back. But it's also for the youngest kids as well. It's like kids going into primary one, primary two, not having early childcare, not being toilet trained, not knowing how to use utensils. Like, you're seeing it at all levels of the system. And it's then, how can we start to recover and kind of heal from that? And of course, learn, like, was there another way? That's something I think about all the time. I think many countries think about that. But even Sweden closed universities in terms of in-person learning. They preserved primary education and kept their schools open there. So even the most kind of, you could say, extreme example of kind of stay open, the very healthy population couldn't find a way to do it without their hospitals collapsing. And then in the end, the people who are shouting about gym closures or about universities being open are also the ones who end up in hospital shouting, why isn't there a doctor to see my mom? Why isn't there a nurse? And that's what we're having now in Britain, major staffing shortages, because those are the people who were yelled at. And I tell you, if you're yelled day after day and then you're on a basic wage as a nurse, at some point you're going to say, you know what? I'm going to go work in Sainsbury's, because nobody's going to shout at me each day at their parent. And that's why we're seeing now huge attrition from the healthcare, because people are shouting, but they seem to be shouting at the wrong individuals. The person who's nursing, and there's a wait, they can't produce more of them. There's one of them. They're like, I'm trying my best. And if you keep shouting at them, they're going to have a mental health issue and say, you know what? It's not worth it. They're not very highly paid anyways. So I guess kind of coming back to your students on uni is that it is really hard. And I think we have to acknowledge the huge harms, but what are the solutions?
Yeah.
And I think so much of it is your perspective of where you were sitting during the pandemic, and how you experienced it yourself.
I think it's also, I had COVID and I had it quite badly. I'm a very fit individual and I couldn't go up the stairs properly without just being absolutely exhausted. But before I had COVID, I was like, oh, this is, I had a very different viewpoint. And then I had it myself. And I was then, I guess my viewpoint did change. Obviously, I still wanted gyms open because I thought for your mental health, and I work in that sector. So as you're right, that is my sector. I want it to stay open. But then after I had COVID, I did realize, okay, if my grandparents get this, they're probably going to die, because if I feel like this and I'm really fit and healthy. So it is definitely, from a personal experience, my perspective was a little bit different after I actually had COVID. I don't know if yours was. I never even asked you that. But my perspective was a little bit different post having it.
I think whatever your views are, there's always going to be people who will disagree with you. And this kind of brings me on to another topic, because we often, being on podcasts and social media, we often kind of get delivered with a handful of shit or abuse online. It just kind of comes packaged in parcel. I always believe that if you're authentic, there's always going to be a portion of the population that will hate you. I think if everyone likes you, you're pretty suspect. And I know this is probably something that you have to deal with. And how did you find that in kind of that period where there was obviously a lot going on, this heightened emotions already, and you're this public figure speaking quite a lot about it? And I know you probably have to deal with threats of abuse on social media, online. It's something that we often get asked about. How did you deal, and how did you cope with that?
Well, I think the first thing to acknowledge is we're all human, so it hurts. Mm-hmm. I think whether you're thinking like people, I guess, in the fitness industry, people who are, you know, news presenters, footballers, you name them, everybody seems to get it, and it does hurt. It seems like everyone does say, oh, that does feel off. So that's normal. But I think also I just come back to kind of what's real, and what's real is your trusted colleagues and your friends and your loved ones. And so obviously for me, like if I would write something and then get a backlash, I would always run that by like the people I trust and say, was I wrong? Like, did I say something wrong? Did I get that off? And if those people say to you like, no, I think that was sensible, or I disagree with you, but you're entitled to that point of view, or you weren't, then actually that's okay. I'm like, actually it's okay out there to have people shouting at you, because you've done due diligence and like making sure what you're saying is not off. But in the end, yeah, it is hard. I don't have any good answers to that. I guess I'm curious how you guys cope with it beyond just coming back to what's real. And what's real is your friends, your family, your colleagues, the people you see every day. And generally people in real life are quite kind and friendly and actually understand complexity. You can have conversations with them. And I think sometimes on social media that descends into kind of mudslinging. And so it's just also differentiating like real life from virtual life. And in virtual life, I think you see a lot of behavior I just haven't experienced in real life. I mean, I had people come to me and say they're unhappy about swimming pool closures or that travel was limited. And then we can have a conversation and I'll try to say like, I get that completely, but what would you have done if you were there? How would you have handled it differently? Are you okay with that loss of life? Would that be acceptable to you? What if it was your brother? Would you say that was unacceptable? And you can kind of have a conversation and reach an understanding of complexity, and that there's black and white's quite bad in real life. It's often gray. People aren't bad or good. They're kind of human. So I don't know. How do you guys cope with it?
One of the things that has always stuck with me. So one of our friends is James Smith, and he spoke a lot during the pandemic and things like that. And he had a lot of backlash, and he does anyway from his videos. One of the things he has said before is, if you wouldn't take advice off the person who is saying something to you, their opinion is irrelevant. Basically, if they're not your friends and family who you do go to for advice, why does someone else's opinion matter if you believe in what you're saying? And that stuck with me for the past couple of years, because I get quite heavily trolled as a woman with muscle. But when he says that, I'm like, you're so right. Because whatever they've said to me, I wouldn't go to that random person for advice anyway. So that's how I deal with it personally. I think it's the best way for me, because I believe in my message. And that's probably the most important thing, to kind of cut through the nonsense in the fitness industry.
Yeah. I think another nice quote, and I've said this many a times on the podcast,
that, love a quote. That
even if there was an old woman in a burning building, whether you decided to rescue her or not, there's always going to be someone who thinks you're a dickhead. So there's always going to be someone who doesn't like you. I think that often takes a level of self-awareness to realize that, because there'll be comments or criticism and stuff thrown at you. But like a heavy stone, if you don't pick it up, you don't feel the weight and the burden of that comes with it. And I think we can do the same with those comments and negativity. Like if you don't respond to it or don't pick it up, and you then don't carry the burden of it, which again is easier said than done at the time, especially if you're getting a lot of it. But I think it just becomes with a certain level of self-awareness and maturity and experience of going through those times.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to hear about, because I said I haven't posted much about fitness, and but I do know like a lot of female academics don't want to do TV or do put themselves out there because of the shaming they get over, do you wear makeup or have you not worn makeup? Make an effort, or she made too much of an effort, or wear heels or don't wear heels, or look at her shirt, she's so dowdy, or no, look at her shirt, she's so slutty. And so a lot of academics are like, well, why would I put myself out there if anything I do is wrong, and I think it comes back to your point, which is like, you just have to, whatever you do, someone's going to respond to it. So just wear what you want to wear, show up as you want to show up. And in the end, what does Taylor Swift say? Like, if they're going to hate, let them hate. continue going. And in the end, I think there are more, like, as I said, more people who probably, the haters are shout the loudest, so we hear them. But there are a lot of people who are quiet. And I would hope, like, for example, very appreciative that there's all kinds of models that women can be muscular, they actually can lift, that actually there's models out there that you could follow instead of, you know, starve yourself to the point of passing out. And then hopefully your appeal in like a fashion magazine, you know, is kind of drooping alongside with the kind of skeleton in the arm, which is not good for anybody, right, to be looking at.
Yeah.
So did you find that same thing in your profession or during the pandemic of where you were potentially not heard due to you being a woman, as opposed to maybe some of your male colleagues who were banging the same drum?
Oh, of course. I think it's a mix also of being, like, you know, having a foreign accent, having an American accent. So I thought having an American accent was great until someone said to me, you know, we think we do everything better than the Americans. So you saying New York's doing this and California doing this isn't the way to convince anyone to do it, because they're like, oh, if New York's doing that, we're going to do the opposite. So I think being American as well is probably not an advantage in during it being in Britain. But yeah, for sure. But I think there's two ways you can deal with it. You can either kind of moan and complain and just be like, oh, I was treated this way, which of course, you know, I'm guilty of doing sometimes. Or you say, well, when I show up, I'm going to be super prepared. I'm going to be competent. I'm going to have all my data and I'm going to present it clearly. Mm-hmm. And if they want to engage me, let's engage on the data. Let's engage on the arguments. Let's talk them through. And actually, let's get away from all this other stuff and get back to the substance. And I think just showing up and being prepared and competent, hopefully over years of working with me, my colleagues start to forget whether I'm a man or a woman or my age or my accent. And they're just like, okay, she's raised those four things. We need to address them. And so, yeah, I do think for sure. And in some ways, when I was writing like my Guardian column, a lot of people thought I was a man at the start because they didn't have a photo and they just saw my name, and my name could be, I guess, a bit ambiguous. I loved it for a long stretch of time because I felt like I was being taken really seriously. They're like, that male. Well, and it just showed that actually, once you get a photo up, once they see you're a woman, then all of a sudden they're like, oh, should we listen as much to that? Mm-hmm. But in the end, I guess that's partially why I did it as well, like doing some of the TV stuff, though, as I said, you get that backlash because you did see professor after professor, and it can be really off-putting to kids who are watching or teenagers and thinking, well, can I ever be a professor? Mm-hmm. I don't speak like that. I don't use that language. I'm not smart enough. And kind of if I was out there and like, well, she's doing it, then we can definitely do it. And so hopefully makes it accessible to, you know, other people watching that, you know, a professor can appear in any way, right? It can be a man, it can be a woman. We're all a bit gray, but you know, we're you know, not all kind of nearing 70, and we can speak with simple language as well and reflect and smile and have humor. Mm-hmm. So it makes it more accessible, hopefully.
Yeah, it does massively. Like, I think it's really important for people like yourself, for young girls to look up to. It's the same in, I grew up in sport. I've done sport my whole life, and I was a swimmer. And it was just loads of like really amazing guy swimmers. And I was like, where have all the female swimmers? And then Becky Adlington came out and I was like, wow, amazing. She's doing what I want to do. And as a young girl, you'd be doing the same for other young women. So I do think it's really, really powerful, especially from a woman's perspective anyway.
Yeah, and like, and I guess coming back to fitness, the thing like I'm surprised at as well is like how many, like when I tell people I'm into fitness or I go to the gym a lot or I do yoga or whatever, they're often surprised also because South Asian women, like they're not supposed to be into exercise or fitness. Like if you look at the statistics of physical like activity, it's always like South Asian girls. So Bangladeshi, Pakistani, Indian girls who come lowest. And even globally, if you look at the parts of the world where there's the biggest difference between men and women exercising, it's in South Asia. India, and it's, and I think partly it's cultural, mm-hmm. you know, like girls are not supposed to exercise. It's manly. It's, you don't belong there. And then you end up seeing that you're told at a young age, you're not sporty or you don't need to learn to swim or whatever it is. Then you end up being like an adult and just thinking, oh, I'm not sporty or I don't like fitness. Cause that's what you've been told your whole life. And that's what you're around in your family and your culture. So I think for me, part of it is also like being out there and trying to break some of those stereotypes, you know. So if I'm in the gym deadlifting, or sometimes you're looking like, there's a brown woman lifting weights. Like, this is out of the ordinary. And again, in Scotland, there's not too much diversity here already. And so I think it's kind of cool because hopefully it makes people like rethink kind of their expectation. Because mm-hmm. I do get funny comments, like, you know, one woman came to me and said, I need to do kind of, you know, I should learn to swim because swimming is an important vital skill. And I kind of wanted to look at her and be like, I'm from Miami. I don't know why you're telling me this. I grew up like water skiing and out on the beaches or. Yeah. So I think coming back to kind of, you know, stereotypes of that and like saying to girls, well, actually, if you're into fitness and you're a young girl who wants to be into football, I guess like bend it like Beckham and that whole thing kind of touched on that years ago, but it's still very much there. Mm-hmm. And you do need kind of that to break it, which is like, you know, actually it's cool to be into sport. It's cool to be into fitness. I don't know if I'm the representative of cool, but there are women out there. And so that's what you need to hopefully get more of them active and doing what they like doing.
Yeah. Speaking of football, Devi, obviously last night, England smashed Wales in the World Cup.
Did we?
We did. Good. We did indeed. 3-0. And for me, the World Cup's always a super exciting time, but obviously this is kind of one of the biggest, the big global events following the pandemic. Do you think the World Cup is a net positive for health promotion at this time?
Yeah, I think if you look at kind of health, obviously like big sporting events, whether it's kind of Wimbledon, World Cup, others. I wasn't watching the England-Wales games. I was watching the US game. Where the
of course you were.
Through the group. So I was kind of watching the score, but in the end, I guess that was going to determine who would come second out of the group. There are other issues, I guess, beyond it. I think there's a lot of concern about going backwards on, you know, LGBT rights and things like that. But in some ways, I actually think all of the protests, the boycotting has actually drawn more attention to it and to how parts of the world aren't perhaps as accepting of differences as Britain is in other parts of the world. So again, I think you can kind of maybe hopefully see it as a net positive, that at least it's shown light on this and that actually... you know, how many countries have make being homosexual illegal? I mean, it's astonishing. This is kind of stuff that I learned about through the World Cup, you know, coverage and saying, well, no, it's not just Qatar. There's actually a number of these countries and that countries. And so in a way, I think, yeah, but for health promotion, I think it's been great because it gets kids out doing football. And in the end, I think we talk a lot about gym environments, but there's a lot to be saying for sports fields, boot camps, parks, sidewalks, just get moving and active wherever you are.
Yeah, 100%. I think one of the things that really surprised me that I was reading about with the World Cup and I didn't realize until I think it was yesterday was that China, when they're broadcasting a lot of the World Cup, because there's like a, I think there's between the broadcasting, especially for China, is like a 52 second delay. What China are actually doing is, I don't know if you're aware of this, is they are cutting and editing the clips so that they don't see people in the crowd having a good time without face masks to obviously try and create this perception that the world isn't a completely different place because they're still obviously very zero COVID over there. I just wonder kind of how are they going to get past this kind of place that they're at this kind of blind avenue that they're currently going down, because it just, when I saw that, I was like, it just seems crazy that they're even manipulating the World Cup and able to edit out clips to make it seem completely different to what the rest of the world is actually seeing.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
That's so weird. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, so people can't be seen not wearing masks.
Are they photoshopping masks on?
No, no. So they're basically chopping in, each country can chop and change like clips that they show. So if there's a clip of like the crowd all cheering and going wild, there's some Ghanaian lady was doing it the other day, they'll quickly chop it before it goes live broadcast and just show like the managers or the players or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, no, China's in a really bad position because they haven't really moved in 3 years. It's almost 3 years since it first emerged in Wuhan, and they're still doing the same thing, which is kind of locking down everyone whenever there's a few cases and trying to clear it. And it worked kind of in the first 6 months because there wasn't much spread and the virus wasn't that infectious. And I think because it worked early on, they were like, oh, this works. We're just going to keep doing this without realizing that it's not working now. And the problem they have is they had a homegrown vaccine that didn't work. And so since it didn't work, they are a bit stuck. They have a huge population that's not vaccinated. So they would probably take millions of deaths if they just opened up the way we are. And also only 1 million people have had COVID there in a population of 1.4 billion. So most people have not had COVID. So you have a population that hasn't had COVID and also isn't vaccinated. And so opening up would basically be like mass death and mm-hmm. healthcare collapse. But on the flip side, they've been in lockdowns 3 years. So if you think they are still living it. Yeah. So
I didn't know that. I didn't know China was still in like a 3 year lockdown.
Yeah. It's still super strict over there. Really strict.
Really, really strict. And so I think the situation now is like, the question is, why haven't they vaccinated and opened up? Mm. Like, you think that's the way to open up, but they haven't really prioritized vaccination. And they also have a lot of complacency because nobody really knows someone who's had COVID. Again, it's like 1 million in a population of 1.4 billion. So coming back to people being like, well, why should I get vaccinated?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no COVID anyways. But it's pretty bad. And I think they won't have a choice in the next few months. They're going to have to open up because the virus is so infectious. You probably know this with kind of Omicron, like one person gets it, so many people get it. So it's not easy to contain. I don't think it's possible to contain it. So yeah, it's not good. But I think for them, it's been like the real mistake was made in, you know, when we vaccinated really quickly and we started with priority groups, elderly, those who had health conditions, and those that saved so many lives were there. They just didn't do that. They just spent 2021 kind of waiting.
Yeah.
And now they're in trouble. They're in real big trouble because if they open, there's no good way. You can't keep people in lockdown.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, you open up, you will see, you know, the country basically what we saw in India and other places of just healthcare collapse and a lot of deaths.
Yeah, I guess it's like ripping a band-aid off a wound, almost got to be done at some point. And I think obviously the World Cup's probably just highlighted to people, especially the people who live in there, how much of a terrible time they're having in comparison to the rest of the world. I think people have been speaking on, I think their social media is called something like WeChat, which is a little bit different to the rest of the world. And there's been a lot of people saying like, is the World Cup happening on like a different planet or something? Because it's just so alien to them. But speaking of Wuhan, how likely do you think it is that the virus emerged from a lab?
We just don't know. I think it's pretty clear it wasn't bioengineered.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like designed in any way. At the start, like, you know, former President Donald Trump was saying this could have been like a bioweapon that China released to the West. I think we're seeing quite clearly it wasn't, because I don't think China would have wanted to be in this position. It's mm-hmm. quite detrimental to itself. But whether it was an accidental kind of lab leak or someone was infected by a bat while on a research mission, or whether it was a wet market and someone was infected, I think the jury's out on that. There's nothing really conclusive. So I think as a scientist, you keep your mind open to all possibilities until you have clear evidence, and we just haven't seen it. And I guess added to that, people ask, does it matter? I mean, would it change how we manage this virus if we knew it was a lab leak versus it was a wet market spillover? In the end, it's with us and we're coping with it and we're managing it. All we can do is hopefully prevent these in the future. But we already know we need to regulate labs better. And we already know we need to prevent kind of this kind of spillovers from animals to humans. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing it now, kind of avian flu taking off here in Britain and a similar kind of thing. So maybe we kind of know what to do. So where it came from, there's a debate of, does it actually matter? Mm-hmm. Would it change? I don't know. Would it change your guys' view on things if you knew it, or...
I've never really thought about it. I just think it would be very careless.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, you can't go back 3 years anyway. As you said, it's kind of like, well, here we are now. You can't really. Yeah, that's a very strange one.
I think it's just like now, especially that's why I asked that question as well. You often hear lots of different rumors of like how things have started, and there's lots of conspiracy theories. How do you cut through the noise to deliver evidence-based health messages which aren't spread with persuasive misinformation?
Well, I think we're failing right now to do that. I think the misinformation spreads much quicker and seems to reach people. Look at kind of, I think, tied into like the anti-vax messaging. And I see it even, you know, with myself, like I've seen viral Facebook posts, Twitter posts that gets thousands of likes that are clearly wrong. Like I know they're factually wrong. Like, oh, she gets money from Pfizer. I've never received anything from Pfizer.
Yeah.
But that gets picked up much, much more.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in the end, there's no good, way to kind of manage it. I don't know. And I think right now Twitter is getting even worse because with Elon Musk, there's a push towards kind of anyone can say anything.
Yeah.
And it is very persuasive. I think some of the messaging around, I think it's like the anti-vax, the COVID is a hoax, the microchipping, that this was all kind of this kind of stuff, which gets takes off quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. So I don't have a good answer to that. I just kind of keep writing my articles. I did one on China 2 days ago for The Guardian.
Yeah, I read
and
that.
It wasn't defending what China did. I was just trying to explain why are they in this predicament, mm-hmm. and laying it out of like, these are the harsh choices they have to make and the debates about it. And I got called like a China apologist. I got called like that, you know, that I'm trying to defend lockdowns forever. And I was like, I actually said like they've infringed civil liberties in a major way, but it doesn't matter. That's what gets shared. And then of course the people who do that have large followings who mm-hmm. want to hear that. Mm-hmm. So they kind of pile on. And all I can come back to is I wrote an article. It's out there. People can read it. And if people want to interpret it the way they want to, they can. But it's crazy what you write and then how people interpret it and then what spreads, which is generally kind of clickbait.
Yeah.
I think like throughout COVID, the media was just crazy. Like the negativity, the COVID, the anti-vaxxers, they were just so much louder than people who were vaccinated. It would come up the one person who's, yes, died or something, or that would be like a headline of the biggest paper, and then people who are vaccinated are like, it was just very, because you can give as many facts as you like. If someone doesn't agree with it, they're going to really shout about how much they don't agree with you. But what you're doing is obviously very, very positive anyway. So as long as I think you know that and everyone you work with knows that, similar to us, we just keep doing what we're good at.
Yeah, I guess in the end, that's like exactly right. Like coming back to the point where like you made, like you can save someone from a burning building and you'll get shouted out of like, oh, in the end, like I just come back to it that like, I just wrote an article saying how I see the situation. It's literally an opinion over where we are and why, and trying to explain their vaccination rates, which I don't think people understood. Everyone kind of thinks that we are where we are in Britain. A lot of countries in the world aren't where we are. We're quite an advanced stage of exiting this pandemic mm-hmm. and getting back to normal life. And you just have to kind of write it and walk away. And I'm working on a column now for Christmas, which was like things I learned as a personal trainer at, you know, my old age of 38 and kind of being on the thing, and I hadn't realized. And I know I'll get a backlash for it. People will be saying, oh, are you saying that, you know, obesity is bad? Or are you putting this individual responsibility, or are you not? And I'm just like, you can't write a piece thinking of all your criticisms.
Yeah.
And I guess you guys can't record a podcast thinking of all those voices. You just have to be yourselves. And I write what I think and then I leave it. And then in the end, of course, I'm running it by a few friends just to make sure I don't say anything that's like horribly offensive or stupid, but you just have to put it out there and then walk away. You can't write thinking of your critics in mind or speak based on those voices in your head, or post what you want to post in your workout. So I guess your videos based on that person is going to be shouting at you and kind of,
Yeah. You'd never end up posting anything or writing anything. I think it's almost a good thing to be polarizing, because then at least you're having an opinion, not just sitting on the fence and never actually having a say in the world that matters.
Yeah. And I think like what's kind of gotten bad is we've gotten more and more polarized. So in a way, like we try to cancel whole people. Like, and I try to say like, you can, like Piers Morgan's a classic one. Yeah. Like I get on with him on certain issues. I disagree with him on other issues. Mm-hmm. And people are like, oh, how can you speak to him? I was like, well, I speak to almost anyone, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Like you can find common ground. You can disagree on Brexit. You can disagree on politics. You can disagree on fitness, but it doesn't mean like you can't have a conversation. Like you can agree on things and disagree with things. And I think that's us as kind of the complexity of humans. Some people feel very strongly about, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an issue. Like in the States, there's some people who only vote about abortion because they're pro-life, but on everything else, they're liberal. Does that mean you should say, oh, because of that, I'm not speaking to them? You try to speak mm-hmm. to them, have a conversation, move them along about why there might be two sides to the issue. But I think kind of cancel culture has become quite dangerous, because we cancel people over one issue, one misspoken sentence, one tweet, instead of realizing we all make mistakes. And also, humans are complex. You can have lots of different views on different things, and they don't have to necessarily align with everybody else on everything. So,
Well, how boring would life be if we only spoke to people that we agreed with? I think that'd be a pretty boring existence anyway. But I know we were pretty much up on time, Devin. We really appreciate you jumping on today.
I feel like I could speak to you for hours about everything. Maybe we can do a part two.
Well, thanks for having me on. Congratulations on all your success with the podcast. I'm sure it's been great for the whole community. To have it for you know, a distraction from, you know, what's happening.
Distraction from all the noise.
It's been awesome just to kind of be able to communicate and speak to people, and made people feel like they're in a good place and relatable, especially through the pandemic. But where can people find more of you, Devi, and where can people find more about your book?
Yeah, so my book is called Preventable, and it kind of takes you through where the pandemic started and where we got to today, but hopefully in an accessible way, and kind of makes you rethink why countries did such different things. And that's at libraries, bookshops, online. Yeah, I'm on Twitter until it gets, I guess, killed off by
cancel culture.
Yeah. And on Instagram as well. So yeah, I'm online. And so, yeah, I will be also listening to the podcast as I join this PT community and try to learn more with a lot of humility of how much I don't know and how much I need to learn in the next couple of years.
Amazing. Make sure to pop us over your next article anyway, the personal training monks. We'll definitely take a look at it.
Yeah, for sure. You can tell me everything I got wrong.
Well, thank you for jumping on, and we really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.